tonight is a special night, and I thought it was a fitting time to create what I consider to be a bit of a milestone. We're going to be talking about the David Lynch universe, and in particular, the phenomenon that is Twin Peaks. A little background before we begin. So Twin Peaks basically was commissioned by ABC back in 1987 and ran a first season of approximately 7 episodes. And then because essentially the studio executives were pressuring David Lynch and Mark Frost to reveal the killer of the homecoming queen, Laura Palmer, and the heinous crime that took place in Twin Peaks, you know, under the veil of what was considered to be a very small town vibe and a kind of a very sort of good old American all round good town type of thing with good people. How can such a heinous crime take place? And then of course, David realized that if he was going to have to kind of compromise his directing and his filmmaking style by revealing the killer, which he never intended, then he didn't want to be involved with it. And of course he left the show, and then ultimately he was lured back because there was a great outcry, particularly from the cast and the fans that had grown very fond of the cast. And then the killer was revealed. For those who were in the know, they all know that it was Leland Palmer, Laura's father. Now, he'd been basically sexually abusing and molesting her from a very early age, and his wife Sarah was turning a blind eye to it all, even though she was well aware that she was being predominantly drugged before the abuse would take place, but never really was able to step into her power and reveal how she felt about it and potentially incarcerate her husband. And of course, the last thing we saw when Cooper finally, Special Agent Dale Cooper, met his doppelganger, his dark shadow self in the Black Lodge, after being predominantly killed by Wyndham Earle and then brought back by the dark entity Bob, Laura said to Dale Cooper, "I'll see you again in 25 years. And funnily enough, 25 years later, or some say it was actually 26 years later, David Lynch and Mark Frost walked into Showtime in the US and basically said, "Hi, we're here." Laura said, "We'd be back in 25 years. We're ready to continue the saga." And of course, Showtime were overjoyed that this was going to take place. And predominantly the rest is history. The return, which was 18 one-hour lapses into the subconscious and the darker realms of electricity and shadow self and different densities and dimensions and all manner of third-party entities and whatever else it is, premiered in 2017 to great fanfare. A lot of the older characters were brought back. Some actually died, the original characters. Some of them actually died. Miguel Ferrer died. Catherine Coulson died. Peggy Lipton died. And most recently, Jack Nance died. And for those that are in the know, they'll know who those characters were. And so it was quite a blessing that David got to make the show with them. I'm sorry, with them in the actual, in the plot, the format. And then some of them obviously didn't make it afterwards, but they did get a chance to witness the return. And it started a conversation that was predominantly somewhat kind of mute for 25 years. And just how much of the Lynch universe revealed in Twin Peaks actually relates so unbelievably clearly to all of us, more than ever before. And this is very, very powerful stuff when you really think about it, because it makes complete sense that with everybody going through their own transitions in their lives and coming to grips with their secrets and call the 12th House of Secrets, and revealing that to move from a more exploratory, experiential phase of their lives into a more introspective and a more kind of reassessing, reevaluating, recalibrating their lives from an internal form of energy, a quantum field, as it turns out. And tonight's guest, who is Corey Kaplan, is going to be basically talking with me a bit about quantum physics, what we call the particle wave duality that David Lynch really loves to use in his meta, the meta universe, the meta form, if you like. And I'm really excited because, you know, this will be a fairly intensive discussion. And then after we're finished, we're going to invite questions from the audience. I'm good, thanks. D-Bots, how you doing, buddy? And I appreciate you getting into it, man. Let some friends know that we're on air, and we're going to be on air for about 70-odd minutes about this. We will be obviously being able to rebroadcast because the software allows us to record everything that moves, which is what we're doing right now. And that's a really, really big plus for everyone. So without further ado, let's get into Twin Peaks, What Lies Beneath, Mysticism and Mythology Explored, which will be a weekly exploration into the darker universe of David Lynch. And let's call up Corey. Hello.
Hey there, Mike.
Hello.
Wow, all the way on the other side of the world. It's funny, these technologies are total. Who had told me when I was 10 years old that when I was 40, I'd be talking to someone on a video screen on a computer on my lap halfway across the world. I don't know if I would have believed you.
I wouldn't have believed it either, man. I'd be honest with you, to be frank, you know, at the end of the day. Let me just kill all the internet here. So, Corey, first of all, let me start by saying thank you, man. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Absolutely.
You.
And I thank you as well. I appreciate the conversation. It's a good one.
It is a good one, and it's opportune because today I actually had my first astrological breakdown session with somebody that I admire greatly that, you know, I met through the guru that I didn't really hang out with for very long, kind of like, whoa, man, that's a very egoic kind of perspective that you're sharing with your so-called community. That's not really what I understand your role to be. You're supposed to be a sounding board. But anyway, moving forward, so I will share this audio with you because we talked a lot. This guy is basically a physicist. He's an astrophysicist in particular. And while he wanted to elaborate, and he did elaborate a lot on the particle and the wave collapsing situation, he wanted me to move away from that and said, listen, there's a certain level of delusion that goes with this sort of empirical lens that you're now discovering, okay? Just remember that to a greater degree, a lot of it is quite convoluted. And I was like, okay, is that perhaps why scientists don't like to see eye to eye? Is that what you're telling me? So if you do have someone with authority, or at least someone with what we call the detached scope of understanding, then by all means explore it, but don't accept what someone writes in a paper from, you know, 1965 or even in the last X amount of years, because you'll find that you'll be kind of taken down a rabbit hole that has very little substance to it. You won't be able to ratify, if you like, what's going on. Make sense?
Yeah, I think for me, one of the big deals is not so much focusing on going down the rabbit hole of how the scientific theories up to this point play out, is just so much as recognizing that the fundamental metaphor can be applied to pretty much anything. And the more you start to, even using terms like the particle, the wave, and the collapsing of the wave function, for certain ears, evoke the actual scientific concepts and all the scientific papers and the math that goes along with it, when my fundamental thrust is that it's the metaphor of the duality, which is consistent with all of these concepts through time, but gives it a very real-world grounding and a kind of scientific idea that many people who see the world through a science-type lens can use to access some of these ideas. So it's this delicate balance of using the terminology in a way that is not off-putting to the one side who sees the world very black and white, very scientific, nor is it too confusing for other people who aren't too into the science side of things, but trying to delve to the underlying metaphor, because at the end of the day, the science and all of the studies and papers on quantum mechanics, which is by no means agreed upon by all physicists, the way that it functions, it's something that's ongoing. But if you get too much in the weeds with that, you risk alienating both sides. So it's looking at this fundamental metaphor that it's even deeper than the math and the science of quantum mechanics itself. The quantum mechanics is just what's built upon that. Is this sort of fundamental metaphor, and there's this weird sort of translation that happens when you kind of click onto it, and then you can kind of see it can be applied in all of these different ways to so many things. And it's at the same time reductive, but it somehow at the same time expands your idea of understanding all of these things.
Okay, great. So now, let's make this conversation count like we were going to. Let's pretend for a moment that we're actually live streaming. You've called in, you're a co-host and a guest or whatever. You're taking the role of basically presenting your truth the way you know best and how. But you're also open to the viewpoints of the other people that are within the collective, okay?
Sure.
So let's start by saying our reality moves in particle and wave cycles, and as observers, so to speak, both conscious and not, we have different ranges of observation, and for that matter, manifestation. Now, if Sam in Twin Peaks hadn't been diverted by Tracy, he would have observed Cooper entering the box, collapsing the wave function, and trapping him in this reality as a displaced particle, correct?
I wouldn't necessarily use the word displaced particle, but yeah, that's definitely the way that I see that. At the very beginning, you sort of started with reality moves in particle wave cycles, and it's not so much that it's a cycle as both things are happening at the same time, and they interact with each other, the particles and the waves, because they are together what composes everything. They have a relationship with each other, and that maybe that's what gives the appearance of cycles.
Okay, so just as an extension of that, go further to say, if he was observed entering the box, he would enter this reality and be somewhat trapped in the box as far as the perception of the observer would be concerned. Okay?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
However, as the experiment, let's call it the manifestation of fear in this case, was drawn into the box, and both Sam and Tracy did see it, making it visceral, right, real, the physical embodiment of the experiment, drew it into their world, and they were essentially associated then with what they drew in their world.
Yeah, it's interesting because we look at the birth of the experiment, the Nation of the Trinity test in episode 8, as being very much related, that these sort of you sort of looking at or typifying the experiment as fear is definitely consistent with that, because when we look at our perception of nuclear weapons in our world, nothing embodies fear more than complete and utter mutually assured destruction in the worst possible way through a nuclear weapon. So seeing the embodiment of fear and destruction and terror as this sort of relationship to that test, I think is pretty consistent with the metaphor of all of this.
Yeah, and I think that's a good way to help other people understand its basic functionality.
Right. It's interesting because I think it's an open question of the horrible things that are beneath the fear, because there are true terrible things, and then there's the how you're perceiving them. You're perceiving them as, you know, with the, that sort of fearful take, but how do you... I don't think not observing whatever the underlying part terror is necessarily the way to go either. It's just the observation of the monster in that particular metaphor is what releases it.
Absolutely. And that brings me to the most important thing, using the Sarah Palmer example that you presented to me. That's the thing that really stuck in my head even for days afterwards, okay? So put it into a context. So I believe we draw the doppelganger that is our shadow self and its reflection of the... Sorry. We draw the doppelganger and its reflection of the darker shadow of itself that represents into our reality, which collapses our perception of that thought which we manifest form, making it now incredibly real to us.
Right. I think this itself has a kind of duality, because it's the unwillingness to observe the terrible, the fear and the consequences of... There's a need to observe, and then there's a question of what to observe. As far as Sarah Palmer goes, the metaphor holds that basically it is her not observing the very real world's abuse that allowed that monster to sort of fester. And I think the open question is what we choose to observe and how we choose to observe it, even going further than just saying, well, we need to stay on the positive or always observe the positive. If you go to the end of the series, you see all of the characters sort of fighting this disembodied Bob beach ball together, each with their own parts, with Andy and Lucy sort of bringing this thing into reality where, I mean, so they are in a way observing this terrible thing that makes it materialize in a way that everyone can now see it. But there are those who are equipped to fight. That's one of the big, big underlying ideas behind, I guess you could call it my philosophy, is that we've lost the ability to understand that we create this sort of team, like a sports team, to take on the challenges of our existence. And so it's sort of certain people's responsibility to direct our attention towards certain things and to frame them in ways that we can handle or approach them. And then other people, the warriors, if you will, their responsibility to actually fight it. And I think that's the question, is are we observing just the fear, the reflection of this thing, and hiding from it? Or are we making it materialize in a way that we can actually use it?
So that's the metaphorical reflection of the monster in all, right?
Right, and I think that there are, using the particle wave metaphor, there are positive and negative manifestations of both. You have the wave, which is at the same time ultimate possibilities in a positive way. Look, there's all of these possibilities in front of us, but at the same time, that's a kind of chaos and a complete disorder, which can be a threat to the structure of your very existence. And then on the other side, you have order and structure and the thing that you're building in your life, or the facts around you. A rigidity, and it's interesting, jail is actually one of the themes of the return, and I hadn't really thought about that until this moment, but there is, you know, being locked in boxes, being locked in jail cells, being locked in a time loop, that is the other side of kind of too much particle or too much structure. So it's not just the particle and the wave, it's also the charge of the particle and wave, if you will.
And the most important thing that we can ascertain from that is that we emotionally charge that. Because we're emotionally charging that particle or that wave. That wave is that sort of more lucid as I said, this more lucid form of experience, whereas the particle is more solidified and it's more conditioned and it's more anchored, if you like, you know. So at the
I think this sort of goes to the core of it. Again, it's duality within duality. At whenever we are looking at a situation, we approach it with both the perception of details or facts and emotion. If we lead with emotion, if we feel first, it's our natural instinct to try to put facts into that, to sort of say, why do I feel scared or afraid or we look for the details. But then also we look at details and we ask ourselves, how do I feel about that? So really it's more of a order of operations. If we just feel something, how do we structure those feelings? And if we see a bunch of things and have no response to it, we ask ourselves, how do we feel about it? So it's a very circular thought, but we don't choose what we're perceiving at a given time. We either see things and don't have a feeling about it, or we feel things and don't have the data. I mean, the truth is all of these things kind of come in at once, and what we're doing when we're trying to balance ourselves is sort of sort and balance these. But it's a shape, and this goes, like I said, all of this feeds on itself, but this to me is the sort of the triangles, right? You have the everything into the one, and then you have the one into the everything. And I see in the Merkaba symbology the balancing of those two, because I sort of see those, the pyramid shapes, as a rendering of a vortex or spiral function. And so when you've got the two spirals and sort of draw them into their most fundamental shapes, like that's what gives you the Merkaba. So I think, again, all of these things are so reductive into the central idea, but the understanding that you're experiencing that duality from two different directions at the same time, always, it's just the balance of that, where you are in the two pyramid shapes, and, you know, the attempt to balance all that is life. Like, that is the sort of the shape of everything, and, you know, that's what we're trying to,
Now, putting into a context, because remember, we're on radio now, and we're talking to people, so every one of you out there at the moment are battling with this quandary in your life. Whether you are conscious of it or not, you're battling with it, because you are still accepting that the old paradigm and the rules and the angles and the shapes that it brings still works for you. You still believe that in a delusionary capacity, that those old systems still work for you. And while you are in that mode of denial, you will never truly be able to collapse yourself so that you can remain completely lucid as the wave going forward in this next chapter of your life.
Is recreating the lens. If this is the nature of reality, if this is the fundamental nature of reality, we've built a structure up to this point to try to understand how all of these things work. And we've learned a lot of words, depending on where we're coming from and what ideology our parents subscribe to and what we've learned over the course of our life. And the big thing to understand is that it's not that everything we've learned is wrong. It's that we've all learned all of these words and we're trying to make it all fit together. But there's this way to sort of strip down what you're bringing to this and reorganize it into a more balanced structure that I think is the way to look at these things. Because you can go to anybody and they'll say, you know, they'll give you jargon and whatever existing dogma they have, and you'll never be able to hear it exactly the same way as they hear it, because you were raised with a particular set of lenses. And it's an understanding that we are all bringing these different lenses, that we can't separate the words, your core language that you know at this stage in your life. It's too late to change your basic programming, but what you can do is try to rebuild your lens, if you will, to see everything more clearly and more balanced.
Rewriting your future by identifying the fact that it is able to be, that possibility to rewrite it is available to you. That everyone is time shifted from each other. therefore, every level of response and or reaction, particularly at an emotional level, is experienced in a different manner, at a different octave than from one another.
Absolutely. And space and time are the same thing. So if you're different in, you're in a different place in space, you're in a different place in time, and all of us have different views of the same sort of time that we're creating together.
So bringing it full circle to say to people that by simply recognizing that every moment that you find yourself available to experience starts at a neutral point, right? It starts at a neutral point where you have what's called the left compartmentalized nature of the mind and the right compartmentalized nature of the mind. And while it's in a state of duality and it's constantly, you know, in opposition to each other, you're always going to find it hard to be able to balance this neutrality.
Right. That is the goal. That is life. Life is seeing imbalances and turning them into balance, and understanding that everything moving forward will unbalance any balance you feel like you have achieved. That is the struggle, finding a way to balance these things, these apples and oranges of life.
And how do we help people on that level, at the most basic foundation of conscious understanding, to begin to identify that process? What are your thoughts on that?
Sure. I think it's about building a ladder. First of all, understanding what ideology you're coming from and how you see the world. Understanding a little bit about your lens. That's why I really like that 16 personalities test as a jumping off point, because I think it's a way to shortcut a basic understanding of the different ways that people see the world. And not just exploring your personality type, but sort of reading through all the different personalities and then taking those lenses and trying to build a bridge from your understanding of your perception to those of others, and trying to sort of remake everyone's, to build this dictionary, if you will, or build a translation to try to come up with a more neutral way of coexisting with others.
Yeah. I think that's great, man. When you really think about it, that is actually being able to detach yourself from the typical thought form that creates the delusion in the first place. And I'll go further.
I think the word delusion is interesting, because it also has a positive and negative connotation. The positive connotation of the negative delusion would be creativity or imagination. Like, there is utility in using imagination to help chart your possibilities. Now, if you get stuck on the delusion, and there's also a bit of cushioning that's required. If you saw too much of the bad stuff at once, that would cause you to dissolve. So in a way, the good part of delusion is a ability to see just the amount of reality that you need to see at one time, and being careful not to get caught up in the avoidance of it, understanding that delusion and creativity are two sides of the same coin. Too much without observing reality, then that's where it leads to a dangerous place.
Do you feel that you've been there? That dangerous place, have you experienced that firsthand?
I'm there all the time. I think the most acute delusion is when I first had my sort of revelation of all of this. I was kind of coalescing all of these ideas into a singular idea, and my brain snapped, and in the ultimate of delusion, I told everyone around me, I'm about to win the lottery and then I'm going to die. And in that particular case, I look back and I say, oh, well, you know, my brain was going through this period of psychosis while it rewrote itself, and I literally didn't understand quote unquote, the magic of metaphor, because I was right. I very much did win the lottery. I had this amazing revelation that created this new reality that made sense and gave me so much insight into so many things. And I also did die. That old me, all of the quantum probabilities of the bad paths I was going down were totally chopped off. The old me ceased to exist. I did die. I didn't cease to exist. I kept going. It's the same mechanism as, you know, Christian salvation, if you will, or Jung's metanoia. But in that moment, from that place of perception, the only words I had was, I'm going to win the lottery and I'm going to die. On Friday. And then I spent 3 days voluntarily in a psychiatric ward because it was only going into that place on Friday night where I sort of processed all of these things. So the irony is that in a way I was right, but by becoming too certain of that particular framework, and I would say it basically is what I just said, it was the creativity aspect, the seeing a too extreme version of it is what sort of caused me to go off the deep end there. And I think that's a dangerous place when you're talking about completely reorienting everything you know about the universe. You do run the risk of everything going sideways in a moment. Philip K. Dick specifically talks about the need to go through this phase of psychosis, and you call yourself an alchemist, and a lot of people in the alchemy world know The Long Dark Night of the Soul or Chapel Perilous, going into that sort of psychosis of the world doesn't seem right, almost like the Upside Down on Stranger Things, in order to sort of bring everything right at the end. So we absolutely do have to, you know, go through the delusion to get to the other side.
Fantastic, man. I mean, this is exactly what people need to hear. They're ready to hear it. But if we tried to do this 6 months ago, I'd say that people would be like, what? Nah, man, I can't deal with that. I haven't got an expansive enough mind circuit to be able to fathom the depth that you guys are coming from. It's not really that deep. It's just very, very surface-based logicality playing out in a much more highly expansive conscious state. Now, let's go back for a moment to the 16 personalities test. I came out as a mediator, right? You saw that, okay, that I was a mediator. And a mediator has a talent for self-expression, revealing their beauty and their secrets through metaphors and fictional characters. So we are so aligned when it comes to the visceral nature of something like Twin Peaks and all its mythology, and all the metaphors or all the meta that you kind of stimulated in me, right? And I kept saying, no one understands meta, man. No one seems to get an idea that everything is metaphorical if you allow it to be, right?
Right. Well, it's interesting that you say that, because that's the thing, when I almost cut you off a minute ago, you said why people weren't ready to hear it 6 months ago. I think one of the things that is really big right now in fiction is meta. And you do have to draw a distinction between meta and metaphor, even though they're very much related. When you're saying meta, it's a work that's aware of itself. So Twin Peaks becomes aware that the characters know that they're in a television show, and that's been a trend in fiction for the last decade, but it's really becoming more pronounced. You see it in many different shows, many different places. But that's also a self-awareness that story is a way of observing truth. So it's a meta-metaphor, if you will. But when you become aware in real time what these things mean, it gives you this ability to sort of cut through to the truth of it. Whereas I think before this sort of meta trend, people used parable and story to convey thoughts. That's as old as human consciousness itself, if not older. But this idea of in real time seeing these stories and using them to build fundamental ideas on is a new tool set that we've acquired through becoming accustomed to these sort of like the line between fiction and reality and the way synchronicity and what I might call Illuminati messaging works. Like there is this weird thing that's converging and coming together right now in this, what I would call an age of apocalypse.
I think it's great. Again, you know, I mean, this is the sort of... See, what we're doing here, Corey, is we're reinventing language through a new sense of self-expression. And people, in a general sense, can't seem to get over the fact that their language is very, very much wrapped up in their difficulty to disassociate from what they think is the way that they should act and the way they should be and what is considered to be politically correct and what is considered to be acceptable and proper. Every one of those definitions are redefinable. Every one of them.
Yeah, I think that that's disconcerting for people. We use the same words and they have different meanings, and in a terrifying way, sometimes we're using the same words and we don't understand that the other person hears something completely different than what we are intending. There's a word, autoantonym, which is a word that conflicts with itself. And there's a whole bunch of examples of this. But there are words that have two different meanings that literally mean the opposite thing from each other. The only one that is occurring to me right now is the word cleave, which can mean to cut apart or to join together. Like, you don't get... It's the same exact word. It can mean the exact opposite thing, but that sort of concept is what is really sidetracking us now, because we are so caught on the definitions of things, and that sort of ability to break oneself from the words as you know them, as they're attached to the pictures in your head, people don't understand that those things can be sort of reconfigured into something that makes more sense as a group, because we're so afraid of uncertainty.
So would it be safe to say that when we look at most people need to meditate in order to calm the alpha waves so that they can claw through the drama and the maya in order to find some level of calming clarity. Within that clarity, they can make informed decisions more easily. So saying that, would it be safe to say that just by being able to understand that there is no set pattern that we need to be beholden to, or we need to be able to follow, like dogma or dogmatic principle or religion or whatever, it's that everything is malleable, everything has a certain kind of undulating wave-like manner that we can follow and that we can ultimately, you know, foster in our everyday life.
I think that the key is finding certainty in the uncertainty. And the word uncertainty has, you know, quantum uncertainty or the uncertainty principle. That's something that quantum mechanics kind of it's fundamental to it. You don't know whether it's a particle or a wave unless it's observed. But if you just tell people they can't be certain about anything, nobody wants to hear that, because everyone's trying to figure something out. You can't tell them the solution is that there is no solution. Only it kind of is. And there's this weird jump you have to make. There's this this concept that you just sort of have to trust in, and then once you kind of get it in an almost intuitive sense, suddenly you can build structure on top of it. And that's why I love the quantum mechanics metaphor, because it gives this perception of something that is concrete about something that is so uncertain. But that's a hard concept to get across to people, that you could say, oh, well, nothing's certain. Well, then they're like, well, what's the point? But there is a mechanism to the uncertainty, and that is the point.
Okay. So let's put it into an even more identifiable context. Let's talk about what people consider to be the concept of evil.
Okay.
All right. So let's go back to Sarah Palmer again. Okay. So Sarah Palmer finally realizes the terrible truth that she's been suppressing the way that the experiment has been, the way that she's been observing the experiment, and by not allowing herself to feel the abuse of her daughter Laura until it's too late, and then she manifests that kind of metaphorical reflection of evil. Okay?
Right.
Let me go a little deeper there. So she realizes that she's taken on the reflection of this evil, and the dark reflection of this evil spirit has now materialized within her, cast by the reflection of the anxiety, her heightened fear impulses, and other subconscious triggers, which make it real. We have the ability through that process to manifest the evil in our conscious reality.
Right. I think that it is this paradox of what to observe and what not to observe, but by not addressing these issues, it just allowed it to fester and grow in strength. And if you want to just sort of boil it down to its most fundamental level, you could say that evil is chaos. Well, the ultimate evil is chaos and destruction. And so without observing it in a structured way, it was allowed to fester and grow and give this force a kind of gravity, if you will, so that, you know, once it was released, once the center would not hold, once her delusion cracked, it came out and created yet another pocket of chaos. Everything is order and chaos. The particle and the wave is itself a kind of order and chaos. And the trick is learning how to balance those things.
So bring it back to electricity. Let's talk to people and say that there are certain electrical charges. Some of these are heightened with greater sensitivity. Some of them are more neutral, more malleable. Like you said, there's an alternate type of electrical path. And then there is the distributed. Is this correct?
Okay, so it's when people talk about electricity, they're talking about a few different things. Ultimately, everything is energy, right? Matter is composed of different configurations of energy, if you will. And so electricity is energy, magnetic fields that are focused, and it's a way for energy to travel effectively. If you look at the way electricity interacts with solid particle things, that charge creates different reactions in things. So really, electricity is sort of the conduit of energy moving between things in the universe. And the question is, what is the structure of the movement of energy? That is basically what we're talking about when we're talking about electricity.
Mm. Okay, and then that kind of allows, if you like, for those electrical impulses which generate our, let's call it our visual spectrum, right? Because the senses, which are illusory in my opinion, are still set within the embedded codes of our reality to present us with what we feel as if we can hold on to, be tangible to us. Okay, so our visual spectrum, our aural spectrum, etc., are all different currents of electricity. And this electricity, which wells all the way through us and creates these, whether they're conscious impulses, whether they're subconscious impulses, allow us to experience life at the highest octave of light and sound.
Yeah, I think if you just have a, if you strip everything down and you understand that experiencing everything is an experience of energy, I think one of the, we've been talking about the definition of words. I think people want to hear that, oh, I'm experiencing this quote unquote at a higher level. Well, if you, you know, just break down music, you've got your low end, your low frequencies, the bass, or the, even the sub audio, the just you feel the thump in your chest, you know, before you hear it.
Yeah.
And at the highest end, you've got cymbals and super high frequency sounds. To appreciate music, we actually have to appreciate all of that. The whole spread of the spectrum is the thing, the interplay between the highs and the lows is what we appreciate. Likewise, we actually, what are movies? Movies are visuals and sounds together. Well, those are very high frequencies, and low frequencies. The sound is down here and the visuals are up here, but we need this even wider spectrum to appreciate things. And then you have radio waves and things that are above it, and you get into a little dodgy area when you, from a science standpoint, when you say that thought is an even higher spectrum, but let's just say that it is for now, because thought is electrical impulses in your brain, and those are definitely higher frequency than light and sound. So you've got this spread, you've got sound and light and thought, and all of these things are creating this giant spread spectrum of reality that we're experiencing. And I think it's not so much that we're looking to find higher and higher frequencies as much as we kind of sort them and put them into order. That's the sort of experience of all of these things. So if you look at sound, light, thought, and kind of sorting them all out in your brain as you experiencing, as you experience things, that is what it's, it, watching a movie or a visual piece of entertainment is a metaphor for the existed, for the experience of reality itself.
Okay, very good. So once again, we arrive at a very, very important juncture where we talk about what we consider to be love's liberating light and intention, the intrinsic goodness available in everything. People need to recognize that they are essentially, for lack of a better word, by using a descriptor in this case, you know, good. Their nature is good. It's designed that way. And therefore, the way that self-expression is then experienced, presented and or experienced, needs to come from the heart space. And to be always in the head, what we call the language of the mind, is probably one of the greatest, you know, inherent deceptions within the holographic illusory reality that we inhabit. Yet, without being in that mode of receiving, you know, data, receiving the transmissions of experience from other people, other quantum fields, etc., etc., we will not be able to essentially work upwards into a state of detaching back into oneness. Okay? Therefore, if we can show people that all the answers to all their questions, to their whys, their wherefores, to their fears, to their concerns, pressures, stresses, and issues, all lie within them. They are the bearers and they are the releases of their own electrical charge, which contributes to the larger charged particle.
I think that for me, and this is the point that I think is really important to talk about, because the language that you're using to describe the lens that you've created is slightly different than the language that I would use to describe mine. And I think we're sort of at the heart of things now. I think the discussion that we've had up to this point has been about sort of building bridges between languages. And I think for me, one of the big things that I try to work on is the balance of the one, the whole, the thought, the heart. And for me, saying one absolutely is the ultimate way to go, it doesn't necessarily ring true for me. I can hear all of the things you're saying, and it's like my mind has to do this little translation. And in my life, in the old me, would have sort of rejected that and said, oh, that's hogwash. But because I built this little translator, I say, oh, yes, I agree with that. I would never use those particular words, but this is the uncertainty at the heart of everything. And I think it's really an interesting place to explore. Like each one of those things, it's my instinct to kind of want to break down. And so I don't really stop on one of them particular, but for me, it's all about the one and the whole. I guess what's sticking out to me is like all of the answers are inside you. And I would say that's about building this lens, because the lens is what's inside you for sure, because you can't really affect all of the things that interrupt, you know, you're going to be constantly bombarded with new challenges, and those don't come from within inside you. The challenges are external, but how you deal with them is inside you. But that's something that you're always going to have to be working on. So I think the tool set to appreciate how you interact with the outer world, well, that is what you're building. That's the thing that's always inside you. Ultimately, understanding that you're going to experience things outside you, you're going to bring them internally, you're going to figure out what you're going to do, and depending on the work you've done or your framing or where you've put yourself, that's what's going to give you the sort of course towards getting towards a more positive outlook and a more positive result.
Okay. So once again, we arrive at a very, very similar conclusion, in the sense that what we perceive in the external is essentially the very, very means and the methods by which we continue to disassociate from our true and our higher goals in this world. And this particular incarnation that we're experiencing is one that really needs to get back to a deeper state of self-love and self-care. This business of gifting all the time, feeling as if we're somewhat beholden and responsible to be gifting ourselves all the time, and not realizing that we are transmitters ready to receive. We are sound transmitters, and we are asking subconsciously to amplify the purest frequency that we can transmit our intention to the universe with. How do you feel about that?
I think that there is this harmony in terms of finding your resonant frequencies. As I'm trying to use your words rather than the words that are inherent to me. I think you focus in a very interesting way on tuning and sound, and I think there is definitely something when you boil down this thing that I'm calling your lens. It's a way that, you know, when sound waves enter, or energy enters like a drum or the hollow, it sort of shapes the sound and then pushes it back out in another direction in sort of a consistently resonant frequency based on the shape of that thing. The same way that an actual lens, an optical lens, will focus light photons and energy into a predictable direction. And I think that's where we're really kind of coming together on this. So whether you're focusing a light like a lens, or you're focusing through, you know, be it a trumpet or a violin, it's all energy coming out, going through some sort of medium, and then moving, you know, coming in a predictable, tuned, resonant set of frequencies. I think we're looking at the same idea there.
Yeah, we are. We are, definitely. And again, you know, we're only ever going to come into a state of conflict and conflict resolution when our language doesn't correlate.
Right, and this is I like what we're doing here, because we're going through the process of trying to build those bridges in the slightly different way that we're talking about things, to sort of find those metaphors. And this is what metaphors is. Metaphors are magic. Metaphors are the way that you bridge ideas that are apples and oranges together.
This is chaos magic at work right now.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
I want to go a little bit more left of center now and look at what's considered to be the birth rebirth and the death principles.
Okay.
Once again, our conditioned reality has pre-programmed us to have what we call stall points within the timeline. These points of convergence, if you like, are represented by things like every morning we wake up out of a so-called dreaming state to birth a new version of our true and our higher self. Yet it's considered to be by the general population, due to societal influence and again conditioned paradigm, that all we're doing is we're simply exploring, you know, a new day. The ancestral, our ancient ancestors firmly believed, whether it was the Maya, the Inca, whether it was the Aymara people or whatever, that every morning when the sun birthed on the earth, so did the tribe. And therefore the tribe was readily and energetically open to experience everything completely anew without attaching to any of the emotional breakdowns or whatever. And then as the sun set in the west and went below the horizon, they perceived that as a certain type of death, right? We're going into the underworld now. We're going to experience a different level of density. And within that density, we have all manner of different types of energy exploding and offering us different exploratory and experiential opportunities that we can then bring in, draw into our beingness, into our oneness, and hold that until we go through the next thing, a cycle of birth and death. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's like so many other things, it's a dichotomy. I'll go one further on you. I think that every frame of every moment is its own reality. Like, it's not just that every morning is a brand new reality. It's every, this slice is its own reality. It's just kind of a gradient that moves outwards connected to the next reality, which is a gradient. But each one has a pointer to the next moment of reality. And that's, you know, we get lost in that metaphor here because everything is interacting with itself. But in the same way that each reality is created from moment to moment, you do have the connection to what our perception is, everything that came before and everything that will happen. So to me, it's about balancing those two things. We perceive cycles, absolutely. And I think, again, I'm very reductive to take everything to this particle wave metaphor, but it's like the particle, you have the sun, all of the intense energy in this very, very dense collection of hydrogen and helium. And then you've got the sort of nothingness of the wave or the darkness or the night. And I think that it's this sort of like perception of the two things. And then so we have these moments that draw us to them where we have less of an ability to create a new reality, and then we have these moments where all of the possibilities branch in every possible direction from, you know, tied to wherever you are in this moment. And I think that is the dichotomy between the two is what gives us the context of our existence, because we have to know and remember what came before in order to sort of understand what our options are moving forward. But life is a series of those moments of ultimate possibility and convergence into singular possibilities.
Absolutely. Again, I can't really add to that because the analogy is somewhat of complete perfection. Wonderful. So, Corey, I think what we're doing here is we've been able to explore a number of thematic ideas that relate directly to the expansion of the human condition right now. And I'm very confident that if we can create something that comes across without feeling as if we're trying to set rules in motion or we're offering finites and absolutes in our perception, and rather we're here, hey, we're just coming from a very neutral position from personal experience, and you can take whatever we say with a grain of salt. You could support it, but don't judge it because you may or may not resonate with it. We're simply going to offer the tools of empowerment. We're here to support. We're here in service to the planet and to help our fellow man bridge the gap. And I think what we could do, and this is something that's just coming to me, I would love to call a show that we do together the Rainbow Bridge. Now, the Rainbow Bridge is something very dear to me, and I'll explain why. Just as there are cells in our body, we are cells in the body of the planetary being. The planetary being being the expansive cosmos, the infinite cosmology available. Okay? And every higher thought and every higher action that one participates in builds a bridge between the heart, the six heart virtues, and between the heart and the higher and mental and spiritual centers of the planetary being itself. So the work that we do in the co-creation that we do in our individuated capacity supports the collective because it offers options without creating solutions. How do you feel about that?
I like where you're coming from instinctively. One of the things that occurs to me is perhaps a key to success is definitely interactivity. Not just with you, but in general, my feeling is a couple of different hosts that sort of represent the sort of yin-yang, and it's relative depending on who the two sort of co-creators are, to use your words. In this particular instance, I would be the more sort of grounded, science-y one, and you would be the more alchemical, new-agey one. But I think the key is to invite other listeners into the conversation asking questions, and then sort of hearing us sort of try to work out how to build the bridge to, and seeing that process happen would provide a lot to listeners or viewers. I think in general, I definitely am imbibing with a lot of this. You know, there's sort of practicalities involved, but I think that this is the kind of thing that can kind of work. And this is one of those things that I've sort of been seeking. I've been looking for various sort of partners to have conversations so that other people can listen. Not everybody's going to want to interact. The idea, this is the farthest thing from a new idea. It's a call-in talk show is what I'm suggesting.
Yeah.
But I think so many of those become a cult of personality rather than a discussion that it's, and people respond to that sort of thing, but I don't think that's the most functional, useful thing. That's a show that's catered to someone's individual ego. And I think that two people presenting a sort of yin-yang balance, working on it, problems of a third. You know, the only thing I think I can think of that's a really good example of it is Love Line, which you probably don't even know. But it was a call-in show in the late 90s, which was like comedian, wacky, silly guy, and then the doctor, psychologist, you know, the sex doctor. And there's just something about hearing people call in with their problems and then other people talk about it that I think is very, very functional and effective, and not just might be a good grounded idea, but also could help people.
Again, I really like the fact that you're so open, your heart is so open to the co-creation, the option of sharing together, growing together, and ultimately fusing our electrical charges together and bringing more people into that fusion of electrical charge to create a bigger spark and eventually a larger fire. And you know, like you said, one of the things that really resonated with me so long ago now, what seems so long ago, is fire walk with me. You know, come fire walk with me. Don't think that Lynch is saying, you know, hey, fire, you know, between two worlds and futures past, a magician longs to see one chance out between two worlds, fire walk with me. It's so easy to fall into the delusion of something like, oh, it must be about fire, it must be about burning, it must be about destruction, it must be about... But it's more than that. It's fire walk, right? That we can walk together through the illusion that even fire and smoke creates. What does Margaret say? The devil is a coward hiding in the smoke. Is that kind of... Right? I think something like that, you know. I would love to be able to bring a lot of these metaphorical reflections into a more kind of visceral experience in conscious focus.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about the concept of asking someone to fire walk with you is a sort of acceptance of that sort of psychosis between two worlds. You have the world of your old understanding and then the world of your new understanding. But to bridge between those worlds, there's a very dangerous process where you're basically having to lose all the very ground that you walk on, right? What is fire walking? It's walking on coals. You have to sort of accept your powerlessness to walk over, to give up the certainty of the ground that you walk on to make it into this new world. And so I think that's what a fire walk is, but it's also a bridge to that kind of psychosis that Philip K. Dick was talking about. You have to go through this period to new understanding. You burn it down so that it can be reborn like a phoenix or whatever.
Yeah, good point. The phoenix is a great metaphor to use for those that are already rising out of their own ashes, the ashes of their own making, you know. And right. And I like that. You know, we're already touching on some what we call some interesting data sets to focus on. You know, we're going to focus on people calling in and saying, you know, who are you firewalking with at the moment, you know? I mean, who are you kind of sharing the deepest recesses of your subconscious fears with? You know, who are you breaking things down with at the moment? Let's be absolutely, you know, let's be the clearest lens that we can and offer the most detached or disassociated perception of life that we possibly can in order to be in that fusion and that collective oneness more and more, you know.
Right.
The other thing that I thought was really, really worthwhile is I did a bit of research on the podcast platforms around the world, and I would have to say that out of all the television shows, you've got iRobot at the moment that's very cryptic. You've got, obviously, the Dark Crystal. That's another one at the moment that's fairly big business. Of course, you had Better Called Saul. You had, you know, Breaking Bad. They all have mythologies to themselves. But the most popular, funnily enough, out of all of what was that's been, that's kind of gone, that's come back, you know, had a resurgence, has been Twin Peaks.
Well, I mean, not in terms of number of viewers, but certainly in a kind of depth that you wouldn't expect out of, you know, just a television show. It really kind of breaks through off the screen into something incredibly philosophical in a way that most popular entertainment does not. It's a much smaller select group of viewers. But at the same time, it asks a lot in terms of coming off the screen and not just being, you know, basic entertainment.
Did you know that there are over 150 dedicated podcasts to just people like you and me talking about, having a conversation about Lynch and Twin Peaks?
That doesn't surprise me. It's interesting how fractured it is, but yeah. It's, you'd think that there would be a more mainstream, but something that I've noticed is, like, I'm really shocked that not one single one of those podcasts has reached out to me to be on it. Like, I really, like, after everything I did, like, I had one guy say, hey, when you're done with this, you want to? And I said, sure, and then, like, heard nothing from it. So I think there's a bit of paranoia when you get into the Twin Peaks occult world, depending on where people are. And certainly I come from a place that I want to inject this very real thing into the real world. And I understand for some people that's just downright scary and I can seem like an eccentric fellow. But it is really weird to me. There's 150 podcasts and not one of them has reached out to me to be on it. And I don't, you know, that's kind of one of my frustrations about life. I'm like, this kind of conversation, this is just a tiny little shard. I can build this bridge with you, but we can also talk geopolitics or all of these different subjects that I can kind of do the same thing for. And I think that, you know, I'm scary to people, and I'm not quite sure what to do with all this, but I'm working on it. I mean, part of me is just embracing I'm going to be this terrifying thing and put out this terrifying idea. That's the other thing I'm working on right now.
But you're manifesting that, brother. You're manifesting that. You are breaking your own particle down into some form of, you know, delusional and or fear, you know, factor going on here within your own spiral dynamic. And I'm letting you know, as somebody who's, you know, I was 36 years in the industry, man. I did a lot of stuff. I worked with a lot of powerful people. And the bottom line is true authenticity, true transparent engagement is very rare, genuinely very rare. So you've got nothing to think about. And the so-called ailments that you've been identified with or attached to, once again, that's someone else's perception. You know you're high functioning. You know that you're multidextrous. You know that you are multidimensional in so many ways. You will find your tribe, I promise you. You will spearhead a movement, I promise you. Because the world, the enigma that our world has become is neither here nor there. It's neither shape nor form. It's neither real nor unreal. It's all manner of things simultaneously bombarding the human psyche at once. It's a tough gig right now, Corey. And I'm looking straight at your eyes now, man. I'm looking straight down the barrel at you, and I can see that, you know, this is creating a welling of emotion in you, and I'm grateful for that, because that is when our true purest nature will come forward. Trust in the universe welling up underneath your cork, right? And allowing you to flow seamlessly, listlessly, and lovingly in all directions at once. Because your time is now. Your time was not 3 months ago. It wasn't a year ago. And it wasn't 3 years ago. Your time is now. My time is now. Non-existence would be the best way to say it. It's like you were non-existent and you experienced non-existence because you were never truly appreciated for the great work you did on behalf of the person you were, you know, contracting to.
Yeah. I mean, just put a pin in that idea because I'm kind of having to wrap up here so I can kind of get back to writing the thing that I was writing.
Yeah.
But I think that there's a left field conversation to be had, especially when it comes to not just that relationship, but that relationship with quote unquote famous people and the sort of drivers behind them in the hierarchy of things and the hive mind and all of that. But that's, just put a pin in that and bring it up sometime, because I've had some really interesting personal experiences having to do with the mechanism of that kind of thing and some of the people I've associated with. So, okay, cool. All right, man.
All right, Corey. Take care. Look after yourself. And we'll retouch base very, very soon.
Thanks, Mike. Great talking to you.
You too, brother. See you, buddy.
Okay.
Bye.